Welcome to the FDD Events Podcast. I'm Cliff Mate, founder and president of FDD, and pleased to share with you the following conversation. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss out on future FDD events.
Good morning. It's Friday, March 22nd. The war in the Middle East is now 168 days old. I'm Jonathan Schanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at Foundation for Defensive Democracies. Welcome back to the FDD Morning Brief. This is the 50th episode of the FDD Morning Brief. I don't know about you, but I find it hard to believe that we've done 50 of these. And with the exception of a few pre-recorded interviews, they've all been live broadcasts. Yes, I have a script that I work from. And yes, I'm aware that I occasionally misspeak even when I read from that script. And yes, sometimes we go live a few minutes after 8:30 a.m. because our guests are running late. Usually the Israeli ones, by the way. Oh, and then there's that time when hotel staff came into my room to clean while we were broadcasting live. But these little snafus are the things that make this fun. Anyway, on behalf of myself, producer Michael Abney, and executive producer Aaron Blumenthal, thank you for tuning in. Today's episode is going to be structured a little differently. We landed an interview with Michael Oren, the former Israeli ambassador to the United States and author of several terrific books on the Middle East. We recorded that conversation yesterday, and it ran long. But when we went back to see what we might cut, we realized that it was all just really good stuff. So instead of cutting Michael, we're going to cut me. No monologue today, just some headlines and then my conversation with Michael. So here we go. Headline one, Israel captured more than 650 terror suspects at the notorious Shifa hospital over the last several days. 350 are already confirmed to be terrorist operatives. That's a lot of bad guys. They include several senior commanders of both Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Interestingly, some Hamas figures from the West Bank were also captured. This obviously raises questions about how they got there. I'll bet you shekels to shawarma that it was Egyptian tunnels. Now, as I see it, there is some good news and some bad news here. The bad news is that even the areas cleared by the IDF previously are still being contested by Hamas, and Hamas continues to exploit hospitals for military purposes. The good news is that every arrest here is an opportunity to gain new intelligence through interrogation. These arrests will ultimately inform that Rafah operation that we expect sometime soon. Headline two, the Chinese and Russian governments have reportedly reached a deal with the Houthis, allowing their ships to transit the Red Sea. If I didn't know any better, this looks like an exemption for authoritarian regimes. What's even more outrageous is that these two countries have real influence over the regime in Iran, the Houthis paymasters. So rather than wielding that influence to bring an end to the crisis that has blocked some 12% of world trade, these regimes have made a carve out just for themselves. Disgusting. There is an axis, folks. At FDD, we've been clear about this from the start. It's Iran, Russia, and China, maybe North Korea, if you want. But they all want to undermine the United States and our allies. And when you consider that, it's amazing to think about the scorn that Western states have heaped upon Israel since this thing started. Talk about a scapegoat. And headline three, the Lebanese government says it will provide $20,000 to the family of every, quote, martyr, unquote, killed in the clashes between Israel and Hezbollah, and another $40,000 for every home destroyed. First of all, let me just ask, where do they think they're getting the money for that? Lebanon is bankrupt. I mean, like $200 billion in the hole. Also, the vast majority of these so-called martyrs are Hezbollah fighters, and the homes destroyed are homes belonging to Hezbollah operatives. So when people say that Lebanon is Hezbollah or Hezbollah is Lebanon, this is a case in point. Meanwhile, representatives of Hamas, the Houthis, Islamic Jihad, and PFLP all met in Beirut the other day, according to Al Akhbar News. Beirut continues to be a headquarters for the Iranian proxy groups fighting Israel. And at what point do we stop forking over U.S. taxpayer funds to the Lebanese armed forces when those forces are a total non-factor in halting Iran-backed violence in this failed state? That's a question to answer another time. Okay, now for my discussion with Michael Oren. He's the former Israeli ambassador to Washington, who then went on to serve in the Israeli Knesset. He's written a bunch of great books. We spoke yesterday, and as you'll see, his grasp of history and current events is second to none. Welcome, Ambassador Michael Lauren.
Oh, Jonathan, great to be with you.
Great to have you on the show. Let me start with this question, and this one's been on my mind for a while now. You were Israel's ambassador to the United States, and you worked with President Biden, then Vice President Biden. You've worked with Jake Sullivan. You've worked with Anthony Blinken, and you wrote about some of those interactions in your book, Ally. What do you make of their firm stance right now against the ground operation in Rafah, and maybe more broadly, some of the rhetoric that we're hearing from these folks with regard to Israel?
Interesting. Okay. Well, first of all, one of the great advantages of working with the Biden administration, it's pretty much the same administration we had during the Obama administration. There's almost no change of the personnel. So it's an advantage for me. I don't know if it's an advantage for others. And yes, I worked very closely with Joe Biden at a time when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was kind of boycotting the Israeli embassy as part of the Obama's attempt to downgrade the special relationship between Israel and the United States to a normal relationship between the United States and Israel. Biden wouldn't play with that. Biden was always open for the conversation, and his staff, Tony Blinken was his foreign policy chief, and Jake Sullivan was the head of policy formation in the State Department. So I had extensive conversations with all of them, liked them, understood that they were committed to the U.S.-Israel relationship, were committed to Israel's security. They had issues, as many people did in their party, with our settlement policy. They were supportive of the JCPOA. But apart from that, I felt that there was no innate hostility there. On the contrary, I think that they were very positive toward the state of Israel. Jake Sullivan, just before he got into office, came here for a wedding of one of our former students, and he felt very comfortable in Israel. And of course, Tony had been here many times, and so if you had to choose three policymakers at the head of a Democratic administration, at the head of a party which was becoming increasingly progressive and alienated from Israel, you probably couldn't get three better individuals. And I think that innate and inherent support for Israel played out in the early days of this war after October 7th and President Biden's speech, which he gave. By the way, everybody in Israel stood in front of their television sets in a sort of like a Churchillian moment, with tears streaming down our cheeks from that speech. And then Anthony Blinken, who came a few days later, and when opened up by talking about his Jewish identity. And I'm just thinking back, as a historian, to Kissinger, and you would get Kissinger to talk about his Jewish identity publicly if you put a gun to his head, maybe. And so it was a remarkable moment. But there were two remarks in both of their speeches, which I caught, and many Israelis missed. And the line went something like this: we expect Israel, as it prosecutes this war, to conform with international humanitarian law. And I thought, we're on a clock, because once the Palestinian civilian casualties start mounting up, and that was inevitable because we're dealing with an enemy that's using those Palestinians as human shields, that this administration is going to have increasingly difficult time. And so I was almost surprised that the support we got lasted as long as it did, and surprised that President Biden has hung in there on the issue of casting vetoes in the Security Council attempts to impose a ceasefire and to maintain the flow of at least some munitions to Israel. And he played a tremendous price for it. I also talked about one of the stories that Biden would always say to me. He says, my father used to say to me, never crucify yourself on a small cross. Try translating that into Hebrew, John. And what Biden had done for months was sacrifice himself on the cross of the state of Israel, because he was paying a political price for it. So there's two issues here. One is the presidential election, where swing states, key states, have large populations who may not vote for Biden or may not vote at all because out of anger of Biden's policies toward this conflict. But it's also sort of a democratic worldview. And I don't think many people here understand that there is a democratic worldview. That's a worldview that has a certain recoiling from the use of military power. It's not comfortable with military power. It's a deep in believement in engagement as a way of approaching conflicts in the world. The way to de-escalate a conflict is through de-escalation and not through escalation, not through confrontation, not through maintaining deterrence. And a deep belief in international institutions. this administration will quote UN figures all the time. I don't know a Republican, single Republican, who quotes the UN. And it's a significant difference. It puts us often at loggerheads. So I haven't been entirely surprised by what's happened. And I pretty much predicted, not that I'm a big prophet, I predicted that this administration would begin calling for a ceasefire pretty soon, and that we're up against the clock, and the administration would begin cutting back on arms supply to here. I think that they are who they are under a different set of democratic leaders. It could be much worse.
I think that's probably right. Well, let me stay with the theme of your books. And I want to invoke your book, Power, Faith, and Fantasy, which chronicles America's relationship with the Middle East from 1776 to when the book was published in 2008. I want to ask you what we can learn from that that history right now. I mean, when I look at what's happening around the world, you've got a world order that's being challenged by authoritarian regimes, and Islamist extremism is threatening to engulf the entire Middle East, and the U.S. seems to be uncertain about itself. What does this all portend for U.S. engagement in the Middle East and U.S.-Israel relationship?
Well, thank you for plugging my book, Power, Faith, and Fantasy, Jonathan, now available at famously reduced prices. It is, I will say, the best comprehensive history of America's involvement in the Middle East from 1776, because it's the only comprehensive history of American involvement since Independence Day, 1776 to the present. And I sort of dissected America's policy over the course of 200 plus years into power, faith, and fantasy. Power being America's willing to project power in the Middle East and use power, going back to the Barbary Wars, to the invasion of North Africa in World War II, to the Gulf Wars. Faith begins as Christian faith, missionaries, but quickly becomes democratic faith. The notion that you could change the Middle East into a sort of a United States of the Middle East that will be democratic. And you saw that playing out throughout history as recently, as the American invasion of Iraq in 2003. And then fantasy. And fantasy played a huge role. I think of all the three themes, fantasy in many ways was the biggest theme, that you could take, you could look at a leader like Nasser and think that he's basically a pro-Western and that he will reunite the Middle East under a peaceful banner. This happens again and again and again. You can see it in relations with the Shah, even early relations with Saddam Hussein, with Yasser Arafat. You're going to see it again and again, that fantasy. I would have a hard time writing that book today because I think that the power element of it has virtually disappeared. I don't see the United States as willing to project major power in the Middle East. I see much of the faith is gone. No one believes in spreading Christian faith in the Middle East, certainly not democratic faith in the Middle East. That has been discredited. And what's left is a lot of fantasy. And there's fantasies about whether, say, the Palestinians are capable of sustaining a nation state, whether they're willing to live in any condition side by side with the state of Israel to give up the Palestinian so-called right of return of refugees. Whether they're willing to agree to what's called an end of claims or end of conflict, that when you sign on the dotted line, that's the end. There's no more claims, no more conflict. That's a fantasy. It's just a fantasy. And, I see it play out again and again in American foreign policy. During my period in Washington, the fantasy in Washington of the regnant fantasy was that Iran could be induced to become, quote unquote, a responsible regional actor, responsible regional power. Talk about fantasies. It was a big one. So I think the bottom line is I'd have difficulty writing the book because America, the America I wrote about, remember, I wrote this book close to 20 years ago, was an America that really believed in itself. And certainly prior to even 2003, 2004, going back to 1776, there was an America that definitely believed in itself. It had all sorts of issues in the Middle East, had questions in the Middle East, but there was no question that America was coming to the Middle East for overwhelmingly good reasons and for good purposes. Creating universities that spread modern ideas. I mean, in many ways, Nasser was actually a product of these universities. The idea of nationalism enters through the University of Beirut, the University of Cairo, American institutions, the health institutions that were established. And in the years since then, there's a tremendous amount of self-doubt in America, what America is doing in the Middle East, and a tremendous amount of exhaustion among the American population with warfares in general, not just in the Middle East, but elsewhere. So I almost think that instead of saying 1776 to the present in the subtitle, it should be America's involvement in the Middle East, 1776 to circa, let's say, 2006.
Well, that's depressing. Let me stick with the theme of fantasy for a minute. This idea right now of resurrecting an independent Palestinian state, putting life back into what has been a moribund Palestinian authority. What do you make of that right now at this moment? Is that fantasy as well?
Listen, I've been involved in the peace process, not as an historian, for well over 30 years. I was an advisor to Yitzhak Rabin. I was involved in the last round of negotiations with the Palestinians. I was an advisor on the Trump peace plan. I've been through it all, and I've come to many, many conclusions. They're in my most recent book. It's called Israel 2048. It's a vision of Israel on our 100th birthday, and the longest chapter in there is on the peace process. And I grappled this question about the Palestinian state. You can also find an article on my, I'm doing a lot of self-promotion here, Jonathan. I should be talking about FDD, which is just a fabulous organization, but I can go on about that. But I have a Substack called Clarity. And there's an article there about linkage. The notion that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the core conflict in the Middle East. And the only way to solve it is by creating a Palestinian state. To me, is a tragedy. The tragedy, you know, for Israel, but it's first and foremost a tragedy for Palestinians by trying again and again and again to resurrect a repeatedly, you know, failed formula, which has never been even close, hasn't come close to realization, that blocks off the path to discussing other possibilities that could actually have a chance of succeeding, federal solutions, cantonment solutions on the Swiss model. I've often felt that, you know, even the talking about a two-state solution is a moot point because there basically are two states. If you drive up Highway 6 on Israel's highway going north, you look to your right and you'll see Palestinian cities with flying big Palestinian flags. There is a kind of state there. It's not a Weberian, you know, sovereign state, but you can build on that. You can build on that and make extended autonomy relations or federal relations involving Jordan and Israel. But if you harp on a two-state solution based on the 67 lines, somehow redividing Jerusalem and then linking Gaza with that, it is extremely difficult. Now, that doesn't mean that personally, were I in the driver's seat, and I'm not, or advising the person in the driver's seat, I would say, listen, President Biden has been sticking his neck out to us in many ways. You know, meet him halfway. He wants to talk about a pathway to a Palestinian state. Say, okay, we'll discuss a pathway. It doesn't obligate us in any way. And what's a pathway? It's a thing with gravel and shrubbery. And really, what's a pathway? Maybe the Saudis need that in order to, you know, to advance toward a open diplomatic relations with us. Give what we can give. Because one thing I am certain, looking back, not just in my personal involvement with the peace process, but looking back as an historian to the 1930s and behind, is that the Palestinians hold the world record of a people who have been offered a two-state solution and have turned it down, and have turned it down overwhelmingly with violence. Somebody's not getting the memo, Jonathan. Someone's not listening to the Palestinians. The Palestinians are saying they don't want this. 85% of the Palestinians in the West Bank right now say that they're in favor of Hamas. Hamas is not a two-state solution organization. Hamas will kill people, Palestinians, who are in favor of two states. Okay. Someone's not listening to the Palestinians. You know, you want to say, for Lord's sake, listen. It's not just Israelis are expressing fear of this. Palestinians are opposing it. And if you try to do this again, there will be a recrudescence of violence.
I think that's right. Let me ask you one final question here before we let you go. One of the things that, as you know, at FTD, we worry about day and night is the challenge of Iran, and specifically the Iranian nuclear program. I know you've tracked this carefully. It was something that you were heavily involved with as ambassador here in Washington. Do you think that either of our governments or our governments together are focused enough on this problem? And do you think there's a plan for stopping Iran from making that dash to a nuclear weapon?
Well, absolutely not. And, you know, Mark Dubowitz, I'm sure, would agree with me when I say this, that in a way we failed. And I've been involved with the Iranian issue on the diplomatic and strategic level for nearly 20 years as well. And there was always a fundamental difference between the United States and Israel with regarding Iran. It wasn't just that during the Obama years, they really believed that Iran could become that responsible regional actor, and we doubted that. It was that the United States would say again and again that we're committed to preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, but the United States was never say that we were committed to preventing Iran from having the ability to make a nuclear weapon, the ability to reach threshold capacity. That was Israel's interest, because the minute Iran has threshold capacity, it greatly impairs our deterrence power and impacts our strategic thinking. And by the way, the world has internalized that. That's why Iran is part of the BRIC group now. That's why there are strategic alliances between Russia and China in Iran, because they know Iran is basically a nuclear power today. It's one decision away from having a nuclear weapon. And it is determined at this stage that it has all the advantages of having a nuclear weapon without any of the downsides to it. So we haven't succeeded. And together with the United States, we have not succeeded. And I don't know if Iran were to make that decision tomorrow, whether the United States would be moved to do anything, because actually, in contrast, the Obama administration would say that all options were on the table, including a military option. The Biden administration says all options are on the table, but will not say a military option. They simply will not. So it leads me to think, well, there's no military option. And certainly, you know, if the last 5.5 months have been an indication where, you know, pro-Iranian proxies have fired nearly 200 times at American bases in Syria and Iraq and Jordan and basically closed the straits of the Mandeb Straits to international shipping. And the United States has not taken any measures against Iran. I thought maybe when the three American soldiers were killed, tragically, inevitably, by the way, it was only a matter of time, that the United States might strike the factory that made the drone that killed the soldiers, because that would have also struck a blow against Russia and for Ukraine. But they didn't. They didn't. And Iran has come through this conflict, for which it holds a major, major responsibility, has come through completely unscathed. And so the message of the Iranians is that there's really no deterrence. There's no true deterrence here. And Israel also, I have been a longtime critic of our policy. I do not understand why we play by Iran's rules. And certainly this is pre-October 7th, but every time one of the proxies fired at us, sometimes Hezbollah, but more often it was Hamas, we fired back. And the terrorists hid behind their civilian populations. We killed civilians. We get branded as war criminals. And Iran, every single time, got away scot-free, Jonathan, scot-free, nothing. And I do not understand for the life of me, every time, not every bomb, but every bullet comes over the border, either from the north or the south, why Israel didn't take out an oil installation in the Persian Gulf, precisely what Ronald Reagan did in the 1980s. Yep. And that gave deterrence. That was true deterrence. I don't know why. And we just keep on playing by Iran's rules. As long as the United States and Israel play by Iran's rules, as long as we don't coordinate response against it, then Iran will not only become a nuclear power, it will become that regional hegemon. It's already, you know, Israel used to be the only arms exporter in the Middle East. We are no longer that way. And the alliances between Russia and China and Iran, that access, very powerful today. Very powerful.
Well, here's hoping that
everyone's mourning here. I wanted to say positive things.
Well, we are dealing with war here. We're dealing with tough stuff.
We are dealing with war. And, you know, just outside my door here, my building, I'm in Jaffa. I ran into a young man in the building, an American, a major in the Army, you know, wearing his various guns on his hip and shoulder, has told me he's been in the Army since October 7th. I just got finished fighting in the Shifa Hospital. And this, you know, wonderful, wonderful young man with, you know, married with kids. And I say, I turned to my wife and I said, oh, my God, what a country you live in. There's no country like this in the entire planet. And I'll just leave you with an interesting statistic. And that is 360,000 reservists reported for duty after October 7th. You know, the units reported between 100 and 150% response to the call up. 360,000 Israelis proportionate to the United States would be about 20 million Americans. That's more Americans than fought all of World War II. This country knows what it's fighting for. This is one of the few countries probably left in the world where people are willing to go out and fight and die for their country. And without question, by the way. And let's keep that in mind. This is a country with a lot of power, a lot of faith, and very little fantasy.
All right. I like how you wrapped it up there, and I like how you ended on a high note. Thank you, Ambassador Michael Oren,
thank
for joining
us. Thank you, FDD. You're the best. You're the best. Take care.
Thank you. All right. You too. Okay, that was enjoyable. Here's what FDD has on tap for you today. FDD research fellow Hussein Abdul Hussein has a new damning piece arguing persuasively that Al Jazeera is a terror-supporting Qatari lobby outfit masquerading as a news outlet. If you like the topic, you can also check out my new piece and commentary looking at the many Al Jazeera journalists moonlighting as Hamas fighters, or maybe it's the other way around. FDD's Sinan Cidi published on how Turkish strongman Recep Tayyip Erdogan has hollowed out the Turkish media landscape to the point that it's nearly impossible to find accurate, verified, and objective news in the country. Turkey has fallen so far under Erdogan's rule. And finally, FDD's Ruel Mark Garek teamed up with Ray Takei at the Council on Foreign Relations for a piece that appeared in Foreign Policy. They examine the way that 84-year-old Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei is manipulating the succession process to ensure that whoever takes over in Iran continues to promote extremism and hate. That's it for today. Read our expert analysis on our website, fdd.org. Read our quick takes on X at FDD. And support our work with a tax-deductible donation at fdd.org/invest. Have a great weekend, people. Tune in Monday for another episode of the FDD Morning Brief. Until then, I'm Jonathan Shanzer signing off for FDD.